My name is Ron Williams, Jr. I'm currently an archivist at the State Archives, Hawaii State Archives. My background is in history. I have a PhD in Hawaiian history from the University of Hawaii, Mauna. My BA is in Hawaiian Studies. I taught at UH for 10 years as a faculty member at the Center for Hawaiian Studies for 5 years, and now I'm in the general public in the archives. My specialty is kind of is a methodology of accessing Hawaiian thought and Hawaiian writing through Hawaiian language sources, which has been really a revolution in the Hawaiian history of in the field of Hawaiian history in the last 20 years. There's lots of us working on that now, and that's, you know, about 95% of what I say we as far as people have published about Hawaii has been through English language sources only. And the problem with that is that most of the people were speaking Hawaiian. And so we've gotten a Hawaiian history about Hawaiians from a very select small group of people and ignored 95% of the population. So now we're starting to access through Hawaiian language and through Chinese and Japanese and Filipino and Tagalog and so forth, starting to access a much broader account, not necessarily right and wrong, but a different and more nuanced account. And so we're having a broader and more complex understanding of Hawaii.
From those multitude of sources, what was the Kalākaua era like?
I think that period was maybe one of the most misinterpreted up until this point. In almost every history book, including the most prolific and probably most widely read book, which was Gavin Dawes's The Shoal of Time, Kalākaua comes across as a party animal, as a fool, as somebody who was egotistical, who built the palace because he had an ego, who had lots of balls because he liked showing off in front of diplomats and things like that. That's because we've read the English language accounts of him. And that period when he was ruling was really the shift from kind of grumblings about native rule to an active participation against native rule. The missionaries who had come from Boston in 1863, the Boston kind of closed down the mission. They said, you've accomplished your goal. You've Christianized Hawaii. Now come home. And so they quit the funding, the support of the mission here and said, now it's going to be a local church, an organization. The problem is some of the sons and grandsons of the mission didn't want to go home. And they had involvement in business and they had involvement in land and so forth. And so they had to find a new reason for being here. And those gentlemen, in general, took up a new mission, and that was to rule Hawaii, not just rule the church.
Wait a minute. Yeah. Why couldn't they just live here as wealthy landowners with big businesses?
Because starting from Alexander Liholiho, Kamehameha IV, and Lot Kapawaiva, Kamehameha V, and especially in the Kalākaua era, there started to be a reclaiming of power by Native Hawaiians. Things had been pushed by the American Protestant mission for quite a while. And Kalākaua and others, you know, Kalākaua, there was no standing army in Hawaii. Kalākaua started programs like sending students abroad to learn military training. He wanted to start a military school at Lahaina Luna. He wanted to start a naval school in Honolulu. He, in 1883, he sent a telegram to a conference that was being held in Australia of colonial powers who were basically divvying up the Pacific. And he said, no, you can't colonize the Pacific. These are free people. And so he started pushing back against not only local machinations of power grabbing and white, push towards white hegemony, but even a world kind of dominance. He tried to set up a Pacific federation with Samoa, Tonga, and so forth. And
world dominance by
the Europeans, by the Portuguese, by the Spanish, by the French. You know, the Spanish had taken the Marquesas. The French were looking at French Polynesia. The Germans were taking Samoa. These countries were being divvied up by the European powers. And he said, you have no right to do that. And so his pushback caused the businessmen and the church leaders here to kind of say enough is enough. We're risking losing our power. And so they started plotting against Kalākaua.
I like the way you started your essay. Mm. I mean, kind of on the note that Kalākaua might have been the people's choice at the time.
Right. Well, and I kind of wanted to do that because I knew, you know, I try very hard to look at these things as a historian, not as a political scientist. My goal is not to push back against any narrative. My goal is to get closer to the truth of history. And so when you look at the record, yes, Kalakaua has been greatly misinterpreted. And I mentioned that earlier, mostly, you know, through those English language sources. If you read the Hawaiian language sources, you start to see folks talking about Iolani Palace, Native Hawaiians writing about Iolani Palace as architectural testimony to nationhood. They're proud of it. England has Buckingham Palace. The United States has the White House. Now we have our own country's palace. They start talking about the things that Kalakaua has done as reminding the world that Hawaii was a sovereign and independent nation. So very much a patriotic kind of support of Kalakaua. Now, having said that, some of the things he did, Native Hawaiians pushed back against and called him on, right? So there is that narrative of Kalakaua being misinterpreted, but he also faced domestic pushback from Native Hawaiians here. And as I lead that essay off with, one of the biggest was the fact that Queen Emma should have been queen.
Wow.
There was no doubt, you know, she had the popular support, but the election was in the legislature, not among the people. And so
the thought was that business interests, those in the legislature, were more favorable toward Kalakaua.
Very much so.
And he more favorable to them.
Well, and more specifically, he was favorable towards closer ties with the United States. In 73, he had traveled to the United States to push for a reciprocity treaty, a trade treaty with the United States, which, by the way, when he came to the United States at that point, he was the recipient of the first state dinner hosting any foreign dignitary in the world was Kalakaua. Ulysses S. Grant hosted a state dinner in the U.S. for him.
What? How could that have been?
The
King of England. I guess they weren't going to come here. The France.
Yeah. He was the first. He was supposed to be the first sovereign to address a joint session of the U.S. Congress. He was sick and didn't address the Congress, but that was set up for him, and he went. He was the first monarch to circumnavigate the globe. Like you said, the monarchs didn't get on ships and go around the world, but he very much wanted to.
Oh, why? Yeah. Personally? Or?
No. Oh, yes. And that's that reinterpretation of that narrative. You know, I'd ask folks to think about Hawaii in the 1860s, 1870s, and what comes to mind? What comes to your mind? You know, what do you think that looks like? And I'd replace that with the fact that by the 1870s and 1880s, the Hawaiian kingdom had over 100 consulates and embassies in cities around the world. Pretoria, South Africa, Chile, Australia, San Diego, Seattle. They had consulates and embassies on six of the seven continents of the world.
And ambassadors with full offices. And
right. They had offices with, 10-foot Hawaiian flags, with their own seal. And they weren't just show. You know, they were doing things that protected Hawaiian Kingdom subjects in those cities. There was a letter I came across from the consulate in Port Townsend up near Seattle. And native sailors had gotten off a ship and hadn't been paid correctly by the captain of the ship. So the Hawaiian Kingdom counselor in Port Townsend, wrote to the Washington Territory Supreme Court and got their payback. You know, it was this, they served purposes. They represented Hawaii around the world.
Did many Hawaiians travel at the time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, quite a few. You know, most of it was, a lot of it was sailors, getting on whale ships or getting on traveling ships. The gold rush brought thousands of Hawaiians to California.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I don't have a picture of Hawaii in the 60s, in the 1860s and 70s. Right. What was it like?
For one, it was one of the most literate nations in the world. Literacy arrives here in 1820. Within three or four decades, Hawaii was nearly universally literate. And you compare that with, say, the United States in the 1860s and 70s had a literacy rate of 70%. In Hawaii, it was well over 90%. So you're talking about a literate population, an engaged population. You're talking about, as I mentioned, when Kalakaua goes around the world, to backtrack, Hawaii received recognition of their sovereignty in 1843. It was the first non-European-born nation in the world to receive recognition as a sovereign independent nation.
By
England and France. And then eventually the United States and 80 other countries. But so it was unique. And a lot of it was geographic. You know, it's in the center of the Pacific and travel from Asia to the United States. But for that reason and others, Hawaii became had an oversized place at that table of the family of nations. So people knew about Hawaii. The largest diplomatic event of the century was supposedly the crowning of Tsar Nicholas III in St. Petersburg. the Hawaiian Kingdom counselor was there. You know, these events that happened, the Hawaiian Kingdom had a presence.
And what were people living like?
Well, there was a move to the cities. So coming out of the smaller towns into cities, because that's where the travel or business was, that's where trade was, and so forth.
And what were the big cities then?
Honolulu, Hilo, Lahaina, mm-hmm. in general. There was also, we can't forget that there was also mass death. Ever since the arrival of foreign diseases, the diseases had taken a huge toll on Native Hawaiians. The demographers kind of disagree about the population numbers to start with, but even if we take one of the lowest estimates of 400,000 at contact, 1893, you're talking about 40,000. So you're talking about a 90% reduction in population. So why, you know, everybody's losing family, losing, you know, the elite are dying. So there's...
What kind of death was that?
Pretty horrible death. It was from, you know, it was from whooping cough, tuberculosis, you know, cholera, you know, all these diseases they didn't have natural antibodies to. So there was a worry, in the kingdom. And that's one, that ties into the story of Kalakaua because, you know, the easy narrative that we were telling 30 or 40 years ago was that the white man came to Hawaii and then took over. And then the problem is this, you know, we create this binary of foreign and native. Things were great, were idyllic, they were Hawaiian, and then all of a sudden these foreign things came in and changed Hawaii. Well, yes, they changed Hawaii, but often they were foreign appropriations of Kalakaua and others to use to defend or prop up the nation. That's what this exhibit's about, is the fact that Kalakaua was a master of taking, quote, foreign things and using them to represent the kingdom.
So the medals, the coins, these accoutrements of power, the flags, the outfits, mm-hmm. meant something.
Oh, totally.
To him and to the people.
Right, and to the world. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the one of my favorite pieces in the exhibit are the coins. So 1882, Kalakaua, you know, at the time, there were over 150 different currencies that were traded in Hawaii. So you could use pounds and anything. Kalakaua knew, well, the great countries of the world have their own currency. So at first he wanted to build a mint here. That was too expensive. So he contracted with the San Francisco Mint to produce $1 million in Hawaiian Kingdom coins. They did. They produced these beautiful coins. And they had his visage on the front. They had the motto on the back. And now these were traded, you know, not only in Hawaii, but around the world. And again, it's that claiming space at that table of for the family of nations. You know.
So that makes it pretty logical that Great Britain pulled itself, you know, that Great Britain gave our country back, mm-hmm. gave Hawaii back to itself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That made total sense. What happened then with the U.S.?
Well, so, you know, to be clear, the U.S. was very much involved in the overthrow of the kingdom. But what started was, you know, in 1887 coup in Kalakaua was a somewhat local affair. It was, you know, we kind of misinterpret the players in this sometimes. I read almost everywhere that that American businessmen overthrew Queen Liliuokalani. Well, these weren't American businessmen. These were a majority of, they were, several of them were Hawaiian Kingdom subjects. Lauren Thurston, Sanford Dole, and so forth had been born here, raised here. Some of them had never been to the United States, and they had taken an oath of loyalty to the Hawaiian Kingdom. Some of them were German, some of them were French, and so forth. So what this was, the one thing unifying this group was that they were white. This was the white business leaders of Hawaii wanting to push back against native rule. So in 1893, when that happens, United States troops were used, but that wasn't U.S. policy. The U.S. had a treaty of perpetual peace and friendship with Hawaii. That was this counselor, Minister Stevens. This was his idea and some other ideas and some supporters back in the U.S. But it wasn't a U.S. thing. The U.S. actually, I wrote an article a few years back on college debates over this overthrow and annexation. And in every debate on college campuses across the country, the no side won.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. The no what?
No annexation. There was a strong anti-imperialist movement in America, right? So, America—it wasn't like America sat you know, saw Hawaii out there and grabbed it. There was a staunch debate going on in the United States about whether to do this. The thing that turned against Hawaii's favor was the Spanish-American War. When the Spanish-American War broke out, the U.S. was fighting in the Philippines, and Hawaii became an incredibly strategic point to resupply, refuel, and so forth. And so at that point, those kind of imperialists win that battle and supposedly try to annex Hawaii.
Should we go back to Kalakaua as a person?
Sure.
How do you think he changed in his role?
Well, he did change. I like to call it his Saul moment, because, to be frank, some of the newer work on Kalakaua is almost hagiographic. You know, no, the Hawley papers said he was evil, but he was actually a saint. You know, and neither is true, of course. He came to power, as I mentioned in my essay, kind of trying to have to prove himself, and he did that by aligning himself with those who were kind of on the rise in power, which was the Americans in Hawaii. He was pushing for the Treaty of Reciprocity. He had the support of local American-linked businessmen and so forth. And he seems to be going along. And he was a landowner himself, so he was making money on sugar and so forth and so forth. There comes a moment, and this is my interpretation. There comes a moment when I think he started to understand these guys are getting so powerful they don't necessarily need me anymore, and that's when he. You see this shift, and you see this intense nationalism and this intense patriotism and so forth coming out of that point. And all of a sudden, you know, it's Ho'olu Lahui, and it's you know, him traveling the world and him claiming, you know, Hawaii for Hawaiians and so forth. So I think he was a very pragmatic man, and I think he saw the writing on the wall and then became intensely nationalistic.
Oh. Gosh, that's interesting, isn't it? He realized it pretty early on.
Yeah. But for, you know, he was elected in 73, and for several years, if not, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, things were going along, and he was doing well.
With this undercurrent sort of still of dissatisfaction among
Native
Kanaka'o'i.
You know, there's some folks who don't read the Hawaiian have kind of taken that out of context, too. I had a researcher talking with me a few months ago about how, oh, well, Nawahi and Pilipo and these great Hawaiian leaders, you know, were against Kalakaua. Yeah, they were. They come out and just berate him in the papers and so forth because he was spending too much money. He was aligning himself. So the Kalakaua, at one point, the government is not doing well financially. So he arranges for a million-dollar loan from the United States, and at one point from private funds and then the United States. And Nawahi gets up in the legislature, the Hawaiian Kingdom legislature, and gives an incredible speech where he says, you know, I'm going to tell you a story. And he says there was this great war going on between two nations, and it was at a stalemate. And one of the nations gifted the other nation this giant wooden horse. And so here's this native Hawaiian in the 1870s telling the story of the Trojan horse. And he said, that's what this deal is. If we take $1 million of American money, that's them getting their foot in Hawaii, and the next step is annexation.
You mean that reciprocity treaty involved Pearl Lagoon?
No, that was a different issue.
Okay.
So,
the Pearl Lagoon thing happen then after Kalakaua got in?
It did, but that's been in my manawa, that's been misinterpreted also.
Ah.
The Treaty of Reciprocity that Kalakaua signed in 75 didn't include Pearl Harbor. All it did was give off trade benefits on both sides. Now the U.S. wanted Pearl Harbor, but even Kalakaua was against it. There are mass meetings across the islands at Kaumakapili, at all the different churches, and they say, we do not give up our sovereignty. We do not give away land. Charles Reed Bishop, who was kind of one of the masterminds of that treaty, he was the Minister of Foreign Affairs at the time. He says, he writes a private letter to a friend in America, and he says, every native in the country is against this treaty, even my wife, Pauahi. So Kalakaua was even against giving away Pearl Harbor. But that first treaty for reciprocity gives away, you know, takes the tax off of tariffs on both sides. It's coming due and it's renewed. And then the second time it comes up for renewal is 87. And as it's coming towards renewal, the United States lets Hawaii know, we're not going to renew this treaty unless you give us Pearl Harbor. This is not a good deal for us. We have to have Pearl Harbor. And so That's the motivation for the 1887 coup. The local businessmen here in Hawaii could not let that treaty expire. Their profits would have plummeted. And so they start to say, how are we going to get this treaty through? And Kalakaua is refusing. And so they plot the overthrow of Kalakaua. And they draft a constitution that basically removes him from power. There's two factions of that group. One is the Dole-led faction, Sanford Dole, who was a little bit more kind of, he was a constitutional lawyer and a little bit more staid. And he said, okay, we'll do this. The other faction, the Lauren Thurston faction, was more hot-headed and kind of, and they said, let's kill him. We have the writings. They said, let's kill Kalakaua, take over, declare a republic, and we'll have Hawaii. Dole faction wins out, but they do. They in my mind, they push that coup, that 1887 bayonet revolution, because they have to get that treaty signed. And it works. They take over, the Treaty of Reciprocity is renewed, and Pearl Harbor is given away. So Pearl Harbor didn't have anything to do with that first treaty, but it had to do with the renewal.
And what happened with Kalakaua?
So Kalakaua survives that. most folks have written about him at that point as becoming a figurehead, which again I think is wrong. Much of his power is taken away because he has to answer to his cabinet now.
So the Constitution was rewritten?
Yeah. Yeah, the gentleman, we have the original constitution at the draft at the Hawaii State Archives, and it's got the men who wrote it and everything. And they basically removed much of his political base. From 52 on, the Kingdom of Hawaii Constitution had given the right to vote, had universal manhood suffrage. Every ethnicity could vote. The 1887 Constitution took away the right to vote to, quote, all Asians. So Japanese, Chinese citizens of the kingdom who had been voting for 20 or 30 years could no longer vote. It raised the income clause. You had to make a lot of money to vote. And so they take power away from him that way. But having said that, historians have called him a figurehead. No, he, from that point, 87 on, he fights tooth and nail to add a chief justice, to do these certain things that keeps kind of being a thorn in their side. They can't really grab complete power. Even though they've rigged the elections, even though there are still Native Hawaiians who win elections. William Punahou White in Lahaina wins the 1890 election. Coming out of that bayonet constitution, Native Hawaiians create their own, it's the first Native Hawaiian political party in the kingdom called Hui Kalai Aina. And their goal is to replace the bayonet constitution. So they've kind of stirred up a hornet's nest. And again, remember, while they have an outsized amount of power, they're a tiny minority in the Kingdom of Hawaii. And so Kalakaua pushes back, his people push back, and that's what precipitates the 93 overthrow, because they get to a point where they say, we have to, enough meddling around with this, we have to take Hawaii. Yeah.
Kalakaua?
Mm-hmm.
What was he thinking when he headed out on that last trip?
To before he passed?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think, and this is, you know, I don't want to reach too far without evidence, but what we do know, there's something I came across recently that he visited the consulate in San Diego before he went to San Francisco. And it's really beautiful because the consulate, after hearing of his death, writes to the Hawaiian Kingdom Minister of Foreign Affairs and explains what he did there. And he was in San Diego for 3 days. And they said he was invigorated to see people embrace him and know of the kingdom. He took a train down to Tijuana from San Diego. He visited Tijuana. He got the key to the city from the mayor. Local businesswomen wrote the kingdom and said they were sad that he had passed. But so, you know, I think Kalakaua, he's a complex character. He made good choices and bad choices. What I think is undeniable is that he carved out a place for Hawaii on the world stage that no other person had. That no other leader had. People of the world knew about Hawaii and knew about its ingenuity and knew about its literacy and knew about its prominence because of Kalakaua and others. So he accomplished that, and I think he knew that. He was worried about his kingdom when he went to San Diego, when he went to San Francisco, and he, you know, as he's passing, I think he kind of a little bit sees the future and is worried for his sister.
Was he sick all along the way, or
he was sick? He kept getting a little bit better and then getting sick again.
Well, what did he have?
The autopsy from his death says that he died from what was known as Bright's disease. I'm not a you know, medical doctor, but it had to do with his a weakening of his heart and lungs and his internal systems and so forth. He ate and drank quite a bit and didn't live the most healthy lifestyle, but they say he died from Bright's disease.
Oh, I'd love to hear his voice. I'd like to hear him talking to people. What was he like? He seemed must have been such a personable character.
He was definitely charismatic, certainly charismatic, and powerful. You know, whether you liked him or hated him, he had a powerful presence. You know, the thing that there are lots of things I don't admire about him. One of the things I do admire about him is his assuredness. That Native Hawaiians had a place at least as equal as any other member of the human race. He did not back down or shy away from claiming his right and his people's right to a place in the world. When they were building Kaumakapili Church, after it burned down, they were building a second version of Kaumakapili Church. And the American Protestant Mission had quite a bit of power here. And they start to devise this church. Reverend Charles Hyde is the architect of the church, or one of the architects. And they're going to build this steeple. And Kalakaua comes in and says, no, it should have two steeples because man has two arms. And he reaches up to the sky to talk to God, you know, and this whole thing. And they say, no, you can't do that. It's 2,000 years of Gothic architecture and blah, blah. You can't just. And he says, no, we're doing this. You know, and they do. And the church has two steeples. You know what I mean? He didn't say those folks out there know more than us. He gave Hawaiians their credit for a 2,000-year history of knowledge, you know, and that's really remarkable, you know, and not only him. I want to stick with him, but also there's so many stories of Prince Kuhio and others traveling around the world where racism hits them in the face, and the way they react. Kuhio was in a barbershop in Montreal, Canada, and somebody said they were waiting to get haircuts, and a white guy kind of said, you know, take me first instead of that guy, that N-word. And he knocked the guy out, stood up and hit the guy and knocked the guy. You know, it's like they weren't meek about their place. They knew their place. And Kalakaua pushed that and demanded that people around him stand up straight. And I respect that.
Who were his confidants? Did he have any?
A lot of world travelers, Robert Louis Stevenson, others. You know, he had famous card games, poker games in the palace. He had confidants and friends. He ran with a well-traveled crowd.
These were like international. These were international jet-setty kind of people.
Yeah, and literary figures. You know, when he traveled around the world on his trip, he collected. That's one of the things he did. You know. Again, that narrative of he went around for his own good is when you see this exhibit and you see the things that he collected, it was obviously very purposeful. He collected the latest technologies in, you know, wheels. And when he was in Paris, he goes to see a invention, the demonstration of an invention in a street in downtown Paris, and it's Thomas Edison, the light bulb. And that's how, and he speaks to Thomas Edison, meets him on his way back in New York, and brings electricity to the Illini Palace. You know, he's out there taking the best of the world and bringing it to Hawaii. He knew those inventors. He knew those people. He also, now to be fair about it, here domestically there was always a rift between that Queen Emma crowd and that Kalakaua crowd. And, you know, and it was a family thing.
Were they ever satisfied?
No.
Yeah.
No.
It was genealogical kind of.
And it was, we don't go to the same place, you know, I'm not going to that dinner because he's here, that kind of thing. But it wasn't, I don't mean to make it sound petty, it was significant. As a historian, you know, I can tell you the history of Hawaii most likely would have been incredibly different had she won that election.
I can't imagine.
She was British. She was British. She brought the Anglican Church to Hawaii in 1862. Emma Rook, Alexander Liholiho early on saw the rise of the Protestant American mission, and pushed back with British things and the Anglican Church and so forth. When Queen Emma and him bring the Anglican Church to Hawaii, the first thing they do, Emma meets with Bishop Staley, the Anglican bishop, and she says, "I want you to set up schools." Schools to educate our kids, and they create a school in which very few people know about in Lahaina, Maui, called Lu'e'ehu. And it's down there on the water near Lu'e'ehu. And she creates it to educate children of Native Hawaiian descent to be future leaders of Hawaii. It's the same mission as the school up on the hill, Lahaina Luna. That's the American school. And so she's built this British school down in the water as a contestation of the American Protestant mission. She said, she wrote a letter, and I hope to quote it right, but she wrote a letter to her cousin, Peter Kaeo, who was a leper at Molokai. She wrote a letter to him about the Treaty of Reciprocity. And she said, when they're talking about giving away Pearl Harbor, and she says something about these haughty Americans with their ideas that they can come in and take our land, it makes my blood boil. You know, so she becomes queen. We're probably seeing a different development internationally in Hawaii.
Gee, it's hard to imagine, isn't it?
Yeah.
So what condition did he leave the nation in?
A very complex one. Again, I don't think it was bad or good. I think, I know that he increased the visibility, the strength, the place, the respect of Hawaii around the world enormously. He also endangered it in certain ways. You know.
How?
Well, through not being careful with the budget. You know, debt means you got to borrow money, means you're beholden, means you've got influence here. You know, I know that he also, and again, from that point, that turning point, he was constantly looking for ways to defend the kingdom. You know, the kingdom had sovereignty since 43, you know, since 1843, but he was reminding the world through his declarations, through royal orders, through all kinds of stuff. Hey, if something happens here, you guys got our back because we have a treaty with you. You know, he was reminding the world of Hawaii's place. When we talk, you know, and even myself, when I talk about debt, there's a truth to that, but there's even another side to that story. The American Protestant mission, the sugar plantations in the 1880s, over a three-year period, the Hawaiian Kingdom government spent $1 million in 1883 money importing labor for the sugar plantations. Now, that's the kingdom. That's public funds going to help a private corporation. Imagine if the United States government today spent $150 million bringing in workers for Apple. That's what was going on. So when we talk about debt and we talk about, you know, the king spending money, well, yeah, but that's put that up against $1 million helping out the sugar planters. So, it was complicated.
Was he mourned sincerely?
Yes. Yes. Now, I don't want to withhold anything, so I'll be honest with you. He was mourned as someone who, again, who brought the kingdom to renown around the world. I will say this. When he was, after his death, there's a group that gets together, a memorial fund, and is taking subscriptions. Everyone pledges a dollar and we'll build a memorial to Kalakaua. And they looked and looked and looked and couldn't pull in much money, and so they closed down the fund. He did have his native detractors. I think here's the best way to put it. That person who had come to me and said that Nawahi and those guys were against Kalakaua. There were lots of folks in the kingdom who were against Kalakaua, yet they were intense loyalists. They weren't royalists. They didn't defend the Kalakaua, but you know, they're berating him. They're saying you're doing bad. But the moment the kingdom is in danger, then they defend him because he's our leader. Like it or not, he's our leader. So, Native Hawaiians, almost to a number, defended the nation, and therefore, gave him his place and so forth. But,
Jeez, he had to live with that, huh?
It's a very complex picture. An amazing, amazing man who had his faults, you know.
If someone wanted to read one more thing about him, I guess, what do you think they should read?
That's a good question. The problem is there hasn't been, the first good biography of a Native Hawaiian leader done in the last 100 years was Maria Loholani Brown's biography of John Papa'i'i. She published it about 2 years ago. She's a professor at UH, a Native Hawaiian professor of religion. She published a brilliant biography of John Papa'i'i. And I say brilliant because what she did, which is what we should all be doing now, is incorporate all the sources. She's fluent in Hawaiian. She went back and read thousands of pages of Privy Council minutes and letters and so forth, newspaper articles, read everything in Hawaiian on EE, read all the English, and then came up with the story of his life. The biographies of Kamehameha I and II and III and IV, Kaahumanu, all these biographies that are out there on the shelves today don't access Hawaiian voice. I mean, they're so lacking. Those things are starting to be written. Tiffany Ying, who has a PhD in English, she just graduated a couple of years ago. She's written a dissertation that's soon to be a book on Kalakaua.
What's it called?
It's got a long title that I don't remember.
Yeah, I think it is a book. I think I saw that.
Yeah, yeah.
Hmm.
But the things that I go to, that I turn people to about Kalakaua are things that are written about his programs, which Niklaus Schweitzer, who's a professor at UH, who speaks Hawaiian and so forth, he's written quite a few journal articles about Kalakaua and his trip around the world. So there's lots of good stuff out there about those trips.
Hmm.
But that biography, you know, is you know, and most of the elite biographies are, you know, yet to be written.
Do you think those foreign monarchs, what do you think they really, what did they make of him? What did they write in their own language about him?
I don't think I know because I've read that from the documents. They greatly, greatly respected him. You know, you have to trust me, but I'm not one of those folks that just piles on America for the hell of it. But there are reasons. In this instance, it was almost the United States attitude and the world's attitude. When early monarchs traveled, the two boys, the princes who Jarrett Judd took around the world, they traveled through America twice on railroad trains and a steamship. They're kicked out of the dining carts because they're brown. They go to Europe, they're taken in as the princes of Hawaii and taken to the royal box at the opera house. They're respected there and so forth. So there was the race issue, but there was also the issue that Kalakaua had reminded the world of the kingdom's presence. So Queen Victoria, the Hawaiian delegation got a special spot next to her at her 50th jubilee. The emperor in Japan, when Kalakaua arrives into Yokohama Harbor in 1881, there were 3,000 painted lanterns with the Hawaiian Kingdom flag and his emblem on them. Kalakaua became the first non-Japanese to shake the emperor's hand. The emperor was divine.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, world leaders greatly respected the Hawaiian Kingdom. The leaders in the U.S. In the 1860s and 70s and 80s, it's not that they particularly, many Americans didn't necessarily respect natives and so forth. The presidents and so forth really didn't have, didn't take them seriously enough, I think. So you see that kind of play out.
Seriously enough?
The Hawaiian Kingdom counselors and diplomats and the king and the monarch and the mo'i and so forth. When Te Mateo Ha'aleleo and William Richards are traveling in 1843 to go gain recognition for the kingdom, they first go to the United States. And President Tyler, President Tyler says he wants to give them recognition, but he's just not sure. He doesn't want to go out on a limb and declare it. They go on to London and France, and they gain recognition. And then the United States jumps on board, right? For a number of reasons, the United States never gave Hawaii its due until it became strategic, and then it became the center spot of their policy. Yeah.
Oh, it's so much fun talking with you, Ron.
Yeah,
thank you
mahalo.
So much.
Yes, mahalo.